Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of Radio Grimbald from RadioGrimbald.com. I am your host, Goldine Ogawa, and you're listening to the 7th episode of Radio Grimbald. This week, I'm continuing the series begun in the last episode. I'm reading the 2nd Bo Ragnar Phelps short story, The Crimson Stair. If this is the first episode of Radio Grimbald you have ever listened to, I highly recommend going to the episode directory on RadioGrimbald.com and beginning with the first episode of Season 2. But, to put it simply, I have written a series of short stories centering on the adventures of one Bo Ragnar Phelps, and in this season of Radio Grimbald, I will be reading the first volume of them. And this week, as I mentioned not so long ago, I am reading the second of those stories. I'm reading The Crimson Stair. One last note for new listeners. This story, like all my stories, is set in a fantasy land, so don't be surprised at the magic or the wizards or the fact that the years and the accents of the characters don't quite match what we find in our own world. That's really all I have to say about this one. These stories are getting longer, so I will be getting done talking, so you can go listen to them. Right, yep. I'll leave you to that. Hope you enjoy it. The Crimson Stair. Copyright 2011 by Goldine Ogawa. The peculiarities of my new guardian, Mr. Bo Ragnar Phelps, did not take long to surface. Some, such as his penchant for purple clothes, I do not believe he owned a single article that was not some shade of violet, were immediately obvious. Others were not so visible, but just as profound. First and foremost among these was easily his profession. Magician's consultant was printed on his calling cards, but the truth was he consulted with people from all walks of life, not just magicians. In my first week of residence, he received a banker, a butcher, a nobleman of state whom he made me promise not to name, and a whaler's wife, who was troubled on account of the whalebone corset her husband had made for her starting to moan and shake of its own accord. His responses varied as much as his clientele. The nobleman he dismissed with such familiarity I feared he would come to harm. But the whaler's wife he took very seriously, and after a lengthy interview he was able to extricate the malicious spirit that had woven itself into the garment.
"Any two-bit hedge wizard can raise a ward or unbind a lock," he explained to me after the woman had departed. "But bring me the tangled, the gnarled, and the grotesque. Bring me the problems magic makes, not the mundane ones it can easily solve. There are over 1 million practicing magic users in this country alone, Corian, and who cleans up after them when their spells go awry? Usually no one. They fester and spread until some poor soul has the bad luck to step in them. And then they come to me." But to think that he confined his time to intellectual pursuits was a sad misjudgment, for a more active and energetic man I have seldom met. Every morning he would rise just before the sun and run around the park in his shirt sleeves, returning half an hour before the civilized person prefers to wake. Many times during my early days with him, I was awoken by his loud step on the stairs as he bounded up in high spirits after one of these outings, and it took me weeks to train myself to ignore the unwelcome noise. Yet although his morning habits were eccentric, they were at least performed with such punctual regularity, I don't believe he ever missed a day save for the most exceptional circumstances, that one could learn to accept them. His mood was another matter entirely. He would go from petulant to merry to cynical in the course of an hour. He suffered from a restless boredom, especially on those days when no magical problem or mystery presented itself, and I quickly learned to avoid the sitting room on such occasions. He would rove about the place, tossing papers and small artifacts about, or flop upon the sofa in a contemplative depression and whine incessantly at anyone who came too near. Then our housekeeper would make herself scarce, and I would sequester myself in my room, though during my first month I would occasionally happen upon him by accident. It was on one of these instances that a peculiar and somewhat gruesome problem presented itself. Although many of the sordid details were made public knowledge through the papers, the true events that transpired, and Phelps's part in their subsequent clearing up, have never been published. And it was this escapade that first brought to light, at least for me, the extent of Phelps's powers and the unusual way in which he commanded them. For this reason alone, I commend it to my memoirs. According to my diary, it was on the morning of May the 24th, and I was engrossed in the task of finding myself a respectable governess. Phelps had utterly refused to help in the matter.
"You won't be finding one, you know,"
he said from the sofa. He was sprawled appallingly across it, his slippered feet dangling off one end and his head upon the armrest of the other. "I intend to," said I, somewhat haughtily, and went back to sorting through advertisements.
"No, no, that is quite impossible. I may not be skilled at foretelling what will happen, but I am at seeing what won't. A governess is completely out of the question."
"Are you ordering me not to find one?" I cried. "You have the allowance to pay for it."
"Payment has never been my greatest concern," Phelps remarked. "I would happily spend a fortune on you, dear Corianne, if I believed it would be of help. This, however, while funding is no obstacle, is quite impossible in that you simply will not find one."
"Nonsense," said I. "Why, there are several right here that look extremely promising."
"Pish, posh, and cockshanks," Phelps said. "None of them will do. They are not what they say they are."
I snorted.
"Disbelief," he sighed dramatically. "The curse of being such a genius as I. Of course, there are others. Mood swings, and the people thinking of you as a miracle worker and sending you problems such as this."
He tossed a crumpled letter across the room, landing it square in the middle of my pile of newspaper clippings.
"Read," he commanded, "and observe."
I picked it up reluctantly and smoothed it out. It went as follows.
"Dear Mr. Beauregner Phelps, it is with great distress that I take up my pen to write to you, for a great calamity has befallen me. I feel you are the only one in the world who can help me. I will spare you the details, for my time is limited, and I am sure you would much rather have a complete explanation in person. Suffice to say that a most grotesque and tragic event has taken place at my house in Dartfordale, and you would do me a great service were you to come and bend your unique talents to the solution of this most disturbing mystery. Sincerely, Mr. Caymond Whitmoe, House Woodwell, Dartfordale."
I finished reading and looked questioningly over the top of the paper at Phelps. "Why, it seems well written and sincere enough. What do you find offensive about it?"
"Pah! Well written indeed," Phelps snorted scornfully. "The thing is an insult to my professional ability."
"What do you find so insulting about it, then?" Phelps got up and snatched the paper from me.
"Dear, dear Corianne," said he, "I have received letters containing such information, or lack thereof, I should say, many times before. One time it turned out that someone's favourite heirloom fountain pen had been misplaced. Another that their pet pygmy dragon had gone missing. Trifles! Trifles that, quite frankly, people should be able to handle themselves. I am certain there is no real need for me to hurry out to Dartfordale to help poor Mr. Whitmoe find his renegade garden gnome, or perhaps stop the old portrait atop the stairs from wailing in the night. No, I see nothing in it. I will not go."
"I think you should," I said, somewhat tersely. I was more than a little irritated by his attitude toward my search for a governess, and the thought of having Phelps halfway out in the country was welcome indeed.
"What then, dear Corianne?
Do you see some virtue in the case that escapes my eyes?
Here is a person in obvious distress, I explained, while thinking fondly of the peace and quiet I would enjoy with Phelps safely gone. He has asked quite politely and is probably anxious to hear a reply. Besides, doesn't grotesque suggest that the event is out of the ordinary, or at the very least, moderately interesting?
I have no energy for the moderately interesting. It numbs the mind. Give me the creative, the sensational. Give me things that break the rules and bend the fundamental laws of this world. Then I will need no convincing.
That's not particularly generous of you. Besides, I think the letter could allow for more excitement than it overtly states. Phelps raised an eyebrow at me and reviewed the letter in a disinterested fashion.
Well, I suppose it is vague enough on those points.
And the gentleman would probably be most grateful, I said earnestly. Phelps shot me a quizzical look, and for a moment I wondered if he could see right through my little scheme. Then he laughed and, stuffing the paper into his breast pocket, waltzed across the room.
Valid points, valid points! Dear Corianne, I think you may have reawakened my ability to be optimistic.
Indeed.
Most certainly so, Phelps declared. So much so that I think I will be obliged to bend several rules to catch the 11:34 to Dartforddale.
You are going, then?
I'm afraid so. Now set that pen down, dear Corianne, and change into something you can travel in. It's a 3-hour ride from here to Dartforddale, so pick out something comfortable.
Me! I exclaimed, my relief turning to alarm.
Of course, Phelps said. I owe you either boredom or excitement for inducing me to take on this case. And besides, what kind of guardian leaves his ward in the midst of such paperwork all by herself? Now hurry!
So it was that I found myself not half an hour later flying through Pedalfield Station after Phelps's lean lavender figure, trying to catch the last northbound train of the morning. By some miracle, and Phelps's long legs, we caught the last coach just as it was pulling out. I had read of such things happening in stories before, but never thought to experience it myself. If I had had time to think, perhaps I would have wondered if it foretold a further departure of my life from reality since I had come to live with Phelps. But at the time I was too out of breath to make symbolic analogies. We spent the journey occupying the same compartment as a dour, respectable woman wearing pince-nez and a pheasant feather hat. She seemed rather appalled at us. And I had to admit, since I had chosen my only travelling tweeds, which were somewhat worn, and Phelps was dressed immaculately in a soft lilac suit and lavender long coat, we did make a most unusual-looking pair. It was with great relief that I felt the train pull into the Dartforddale station, and we were at last able to leave the woman's disapproving stare behind. The station was large, as country stations go. It was set on a rise overlooking the green expanse of the Shentwood, with the south end of the Ennish Highlands looming mistily in the distance. The day was overcast, with thin, sickly clouds rolling slowly across the sky and periodically blocking out the sunlight. The air was nipping and cold, and we strode briskly across the platform to where there was, most fortunately, a cab waiting by the side of the road. The driver was huddled reading the newspaper, the reins draped loosely over his knees, while his horse munched contentedly out of a grain bag. When he saw us approaching, he did a double take, went back to his paper, and then dropped it altogether and stared.
"Are we interrupting anything?" Phelps asked sardonically. "I had been hoping you would favour us with a lift. But if your paper is too engrossing, I could conceivably drive myself."
"Oh!" cried the man, jumping up and folding the paper so suddenly he startled his own horse.
"No, no, sir. That's why I am here. To drive you, Mr. Phelps, sir. Although, to tell the truth, I had about given up on your coming, seeing as Mr. Whitmo never got a reply, and—"
He trailed off under Phelps's penetrating stare, mumbled something else incoherently, and hopped down to detach his horse's grain bag.
"Won't be a moment, sir,"
he finished, ushering us into his cab.
"Interesting," Phelps muttered once we were in motion.
"That he sent a man to meet us," I said. I thought it was rather considerate. But how did he recognize you?
Phelps plucked at his lavender long coat. The color. It tends to stick in people's memory. But that wasn't what I meant.
Oh?
This coat has a strong ward spell on it.
A ward spell?
I asked, unsure I heard properly.
I saw nothing.
You don't see spells. Not usually, Phelps said. But this one was particularly obvious.
It wasn't obvious to me, I said blandly. Pray tell, what does this ward spell do?
Phelps ran his hand over the draperies by the window and touched the woodwork lightly with his fingers.
It is to keep the forest out, he said quietly,
and proceeded to spend the remainder of the ride with his chin resting on his hands, sunk in thought.
House Woodwell was a sprawling estate, almost indiscernible from the forest around it. Oaks and beeches, twisted with time and weather, grew so close to the road it was like a tunnel with a ceiling made of branches. Through the gaps between their trunks I glimpsed the dark extent of the forest beyond, moss and bracken, with every now and then a sycamore's mottled white bark standing out against the dull browns and greens. We passed through a grand wrought-iron gate, but the scenery changed hardly at all, though there was a small man-made lake to the right, which the road wound around. I glimpsed a lawn through the trees at one point, but it was a wild, overgrown thing and looked much neglected. The house itself was the same colour as the forest around it. Aging brick and stonework were covered in moss and lichen. Ivy trailed up the sides, and at one point a tree had grown so close to the wall it spread over the roof as though it sought to collapse it. The cab crunched to a halt outside the front door, and a flustered young footman came hurrying down from the house. Because Phelps had already let himself out, he was forced to come around and open my door rather hurriedly, as Phelps immediately marched off toward the house. I nodded to him as I stepped down, wishing with all my heart I could stretch my back, which was sore from the ride, but felt that it was up to me to retain what small amount of respectability I could, given Phelps's eccentric behaviour. Phelps himself waited impatiently at the door as I marched across the gravel. The footman showed us into the hall, and was just saying that the master would be down shortly, when said master burst through a door to the side of the hall and bounded up to meet us. Cayman Whitmoe was a tall, thin, nervous man. He had a long, nervous face, thin, spidery hands, and his whole body seemed bent with worry and care. He gave the impression of an ordinarily respectable man who had recently suffered some catastrophe, for although his coat was well made, it was of mourning black, and his collar had been tugged sideways, and his brown-grey hair was wild and unkempt.
"Mr. Phelps, sir!" he cried.
Tall as he was, when he and Phelps stood toe to toe to exchange greetings, the latter was still a hair taller than he.
"We had almost despaired of your coming."
"Yes, yes," said Phelps, waving it aside.
"It is my ward, Miss Birch, here, whom you have to thank."
Whitmoe turned to me in surprise, but shook my hand quite handsomely and said with utmost respect,
"Then thank you from the bottom of my heart. It means so much to us."
"Oh, not at all," said I, slightly taken aback. "It is our pleasure."
Phelps gave me an exasperated look over the top of Whitmoe's ruffled hair and set off down the hall.
"This way, is it?"
"Yes, yes, of course,"
Whitmoe said, trotting after him. The man seemed incapable of walking at a normal speed.
"I am really thankful you are here, for the wizard was quite baffled."
Phelps's expression went perfectly blank, and he turned to look at Whitmoe, who was now forced to slow his trot to an idiotic sort of skip.
"Then you have already acquired magical assistance," he said gravely. "I warn you, he may not take kindly to another encroaching on his territory."
It was Mr. Whitmoe's turn to be taken aback, but he recovered beautifully.
"Oh, no! Wizard Caleb is the one who suggested I write to you. He said the problem was for a proper magician, and you were the best he knew. It is this room here. I fear it will make itself rather obvious once we go through this door just here. Oh!"
He stopped with his hand on the doorknob and looked nervously from Phelps to me.
"What awaits inside? I'm not sure a lady would take well to it. I can have Simmons show you to the library, if you would prefer to wait there while—
Nonsense, said Phelps.
There is nothing wrong with Miss Birch's nerves, and I don't think she would appreciate being left out. Isn't that right? I had to agree that it was perfectly right, in fact mirrored the very thoughts I was having. Yet I was more than a little apprehensive as Whitmo, with misgiving written all over his face, opened the door and showed us in. The room appeared to be a long, low gallery. Framed portraits hung on the wall, and two suits of armour stood guard on either side of the door. There were bookcases and a few windows along one side. A low fire crackled away at the far end, and a rich burgundy rug ran the length of the room. But it was the stairway that caught my attention. There was a flight of stairs that ran down from the far right corner, opposite the fireplace. They were straight, with perhaps 20 steps. And every single step was covered in bright, wet, red blood. My first impression was that someone had tipped over a large bucket of red paint at the top, and it had spilled down over each step. But it wasn't paint, for although I had never been involved in any kind of bloody situation before, I recognized the smell, and the way it dripped from stair to stair indicated that it was a much thinner liquid than paint. There was so much of it, almost like a cascade in slow motion. It shone in the firelight, giving it a disturbingly pretty look. Except that this was blood, and it had to have come from someone. After staring at the stairs for a little over a minute, I slowly began to see bright yellow lights pushing their way into my field of vision. I blinked, but they did not go away. The whole room seemed to be oversaturated with the unearthly light. Then I began to feel dizzy and a bit ill, and I just had the presence of mind to grab hold of Phelps's arm as I fainted dead away. It was most embarrassing. I awoke to find myself stretched upon a sofa in what I later discovered to be the library, with Phelps bent over me and Whitmo hovering worriedly behind. There was also a domineering woman with iron-grey hair who looked rather like a tub in an apron, standing by my feet, and she was speaking in severe tones to both men.
"How could you be so irresponsible?"
I heard her say, as the last fogs of unconsciousness cleared my head.
"An innocent young girl subjected to that without even an ounce of warning. I can't say I always follow your logic, Mr. Whitmo, and I daren't say I'll ever understand yours, Mr. Phelps."
"Most people don't," Phelps said absent-mindedly. I found he was looking down at me with something that seemed close to real concern on his face. "Are you all right, Corianne?" he asked. This effect was so strange that I sat up at once, perhaps a little too fast, for I went dizzy again on the spot.
"Quite!" I replied with force, staring hard at my feet while waiting for my vision to return.
"Miss Birch," Mr. Whitmo said, leaning over Phelps's shoulder, "you are welcome to amuse yourself in the library while we investigate this matter. I'll have Thornworth make up some tea for you."
The tub in the apron made approving noises.
"Not suitable for a young girl, the sight of something so bloody as that. I should have taken charge of her at once."
At the prospect of being left alone with this unsufferable woman, suddenly an eerie staircase covered with blood did not seem so horrifying. I got up, this time carefully and sedately, and nodded to both men.
"If it please you, sirs," I said, "I feel myself sufficiently refreshed. You may return to your work, and I shall accompany you. I promise I will show no such weakness again."
And I sailed off toward the door, chancing a look back to catch Phelps's reaction, which was one of surprise mixed with something that might have been smugness. Whitmo was shocked, but never lost his manners for an instant. He bounded to the door and opened it for me, and we went out, Phelps leading the way down to the room with the crimson stare. When we got there, we found a short, portly man with a bushy moustache waiting by the door. He wore a modest tweed suit with a tartan scarf draped around his shoulders, the only concession to his profession
being a long pointed hat with a wide brim which she had folded up and stuffed under one arm.
"Ah, Mr. Whitmo, there you are at last," cried he, coming forward to meet us.
He shook Mr. Whitmo's hand, and then Phelps's most deferentially, when the latter was introduced. He made a bow to me.
"I'm honoured to meet you, sir," he said to my guardian. "Why, when Mr. Whitmo wrote you, I hadn't thought you would reply in person. It is an honour, sir, an honour."
"Yes, this is our wizard Caleb," said Whitmo, ushering us inside.
"And very glad to see you here, Mr. Phelps, sir," Caleb said. "I've known this land, man and boy, but there seem to be other powers at work I'm afraid I cannot fathom."
"I gathered something of the sort,"
Phelps remarked, taking another glance at the stair. I found that, on second acquaintance, it did not have any ill effect on me, aside from a slight queasiness I had no appetite to speak of for the rest of the day. But Phelps was looking at it as though someone had given him a present, his eyes bright and shining, and an alertness about his face and manner that was somewhat intimidating.
"I think it is high time you told us your story, Mr. Whitmo."
Mr. Whitmo looked a little startled at this change in my companion, but nonetheless showed us all into chairs, himself standing by the fireplace, nervously lighting a pipe.
"I will honestly try to give all the details," said he, "for I do not know where our current problem stems from. But first I must tell you the course of events that led up to our situation."
He paused, as if considering where to start.
"I am a solicitor by trade, and some years ago I had the honour of being promoted to a clerk of the Secretary of State. Because of this I have had to live the better part of those years at court, away from my home and my wife. Although I was allowed visits, my work dictated that they must be few and far between. Some months ago, I received a letter from my wife's physician telling me that she had fallen ill with some malady of the bone, but that with proper medication and treatment she should make a complete recovery. Alas, it was not to be. My wife died quite recently, upon those very stairs. I was away at the time, but Thornworth tells me that she found my wife at the bottom of the stair, her neck broken."
Here Whitmo paused again, obviously to calm himself. He cleared his throat several times and continued.
"It seemed a straightforward enough tragedy. We had the coroner out, and along with my physician, he made a complete investigation. They unanimously agreed that my poor wife had died of a fracture in her neck, probably caused by tripping and falling down those stairs. They suspected no foul play at all. In her worsening condition, my wife was prone to bouts of dizziness and bad balance, and it was perfectly likely that she could have tripped. And that is what I still believe."
Phelps was looking appreciatively blank at this point, resting in an armchair with his fingertips pressed together and his eyes half shut. He looked almost as though he were asleep, but they flickered open again when our host stopped talking, and they were as bright and awake as ever.
"That does not explain how you came to summon me out here," he said, "nor the rather wet problem upon your stair."
"Do not make light of Mr. Whitmore's predicament," Caleb chided gently. "I have already had those stairs cleaned twice during my initial investigation. The blood always came back."
"Came back?"
Phelps's head whipped around so fast I expected his neck to crack.
"Came back from where?"
"I am coming to that, Mr. Phelps, sir," Whitmo cut in. "What I've told you so far is only the background."
"Then, by all means, please continue."
Whitmo cleared his throat nervously.
"We first noticed it the day after I arrived. That was 2 days after my wife's death. It started as a small puddle on the second step from the top, almost impossible to see because the carpet itself is a deep maroon colour. The maid first noticed it and suspected a prank from one of the stable girls. She cleaned it up and said no more about it. But that afternoon, when I had occasion to look at the stairs, it had grown into a small stream that ran halfway down them, and there was no mistaking that it was blood. I had the housekeeper and the maids clean it up, and I spent the remainder of the day very confused and uneasy."
The next morning it had grown into what you see here. It took my entire staff almost 2 days to get it off, by which time there was a new puddle growing at the top. I wired Wizard Caleb that afternoon, and he was able to come down the next morning. Caleb coughed.
I can't say I ever had a clue as to what was going on, he admitted. But I made a thorough investigation, and had them cleaned as well.
And? Phelps asked.
I found nothing. They are perfectly ordinary stairs, aside from their tendency to bleed.
How quickly do they bleed?
Not 2 hours after the first cleaning, the blood was back, and thicker than ever.
And the blood itself?
The wizard's face darkened.
It is without a doubt human blood. Of that I am certain.
Do you have any samples, preferably of the stuff you cleaned off?
Whitmo looked bewildered, but Caleb reached into his coat pocket and pulled out a small tube, half full of red liquid.
Phelps fairly leapt out of his chair and took it, holding it up so the light shone through it and illuminated the contents. What part of the stair was this taken from?
The puddle at the bottom, Caleb said.
Phelps interrupted. Still, it may prove useful.
He tucked the vial into his own pocket, ignoring the wizard's weak protest.
Mr. Whitmo, where do you believe the blood has come from?
Whitmo looked speechless and didn't say anything at first.
I'm sure I don't know, he said. I have nightmarish fantasies, but nothing that could possibly... Yet you believe it is connected with your wife's death.
Whitmo made a non-committal noise and looked away. Phelps gave him a hard stare for a few moments, and then he strode over to the foot of the stair and stood just beyond the puddle of blood at the bottom. Out of his pocket, he took an empty glass vial of his own and carefully dipped it in the liquid. He held it up to the light, frowned, and put it away. Then he stood up and, quite nimbly, climbed onto the banister. He balanced there for a moment, bent over slightly, and then began to walk right up it as though he were sauntering into someone's lounge. This caused a cry of alarm from all present, including myself, but Phelps ignored us. At the top, he swung himself off and crouched at the head of the stairs where the blood began. Here, he took a third sample, but also dipped his finger in the stuff. Holding it up to the light, he made a face which might have been disgust, and hastily wiped it off onto the carpet.
"I'll grant you this one, Corianne," he called down to me. "There have been things here, very much worth seeing."
He rose to his feet, tucking the third vial away in his pocket, and with great ceremony began to descend the stairs. This caused another startled outcry, but Phelps seemed not to care. "Squelch, squelch, squelch," went his shoes down the stairs, slowly and deliberately.
"So far as I can see," he said, "squelch, squelch, squelch. This unusual incident has roots which stretch back much farther than the immediate problem.
Squelch, squelch, squelch.
And, unfortunately, I cannot solve it for you. I can show you the why."
Squelch, squelch, squelch.
"The what?"
Squelch, squelch.
"And the how?"
Squelch.
"But whether or not you will act upon my advice is entirely up to you."
He reached the bottom of the stairs, and I noticed he was gripping the handrail so hard that his knuckles had turned white, and there was a strained expression upon his face as he stood there in the small puddle of blood at the bottom.
Whitmo did not seem to notice. "Oh, sir, do you really think you can enlighten us?"
"Without a doubt,"
Phelps said, carefully stepping out of the puddle.
"I have very nearly unravelled it already.
I just need clarification on a few points from you."
"I am at your service, sir."
"Just how old is this house, exactly?"
120 years, sir."
"Excellent. And did the wood come from this local forest?"
"As a matter of fact, I believe it did not. The builder had the stuff shipped in from Enwall for some reason."
Phelps's brow furrowed at that. He turned back to glare at the stairs as if this were somehow their fault.
"Now that is rather disappointing,"
he said, rubbing his chin. Are you certain there was no local timber used?
Whitmo looked thoughtful.
Well, he said after some minutes, did you know one of those stairs is made of local wood? It had rotted through some years ago, and we had occasion to replace it. For that, we used some wood from a tree on the estate.
Phelps whipped round on him, making the poor man jump.
The top step.
Hoy.
Why, yes, sir.
How did you guess?
Because it is the top step, Mr. Whitmo, that is the source of all your problems, and perhaps even your wife's untimely end.
Oh, come now, cried Caleb. Do you mean to tell me that all this stems from a single piece of wood?
Phelps looked quizzically over at the man.
A wizard's staff is his most dangerous asset, Wizard Caleb, and that is made of wood. Wood makes an excellent magical conductor, given the right treatment. Some wood is quite magical to begin with. That wood,
he pointed at the glistening step,
obviously has more to it than your average piece of lumber.
How do you conclude that?
By looking, with more than my eyes, Phelps said, growing tired and severe.
I suddenly pitied poor Caleb, who obviously could not read my guardian's mood swings and didn't know what he was in for.
Phelps looked from one man to the other and sighed. If you bothered to look a little harder, said he, you would see where the blood is coming from. It is coming from that top step. The wood in that step, my good sirs, is bleeding.
A ringing silence filled the room.
Whitmo was wan and nervous. Caleb seemed deflated. Myself, I fancy, was some shade of green and probably on the edge of my seat. I glanced furtively back up at the stairs, and I couldn't help but agree that the blood did seem to spring right out of that first step. It made my stomach turn just to think about it, and I had to look away. Mr. Phelps, Whitmo beseeched, what advice can you offer me?
Phelps, who had been staring vacantly at the stairs, looked up and seemed momentarily disconcerted, as if he expected to be someplace different. But soon his expression cleared, and he smiled gently.
For you, Mr. Whitmo, the best advice I can offer is to stop fraying your nerves so. Unless we are extraordinarily unfortunate, I do not see why this whole matter cannot be settled by tonight.
Whitmo's face lit up at this, and Caleb looked astonished.
"In that case, we are all in your hands," exclaimed Whitmo, almost dancing on the spot. "What is your plan of action?" "Oh, no action. No action at all," Phelps said placidly. "I believe there has been enough action of late. No, we'll only be putting the pieces back together. But for now, I think your time may best be served by showing myself and Miss Birch where the wood from that top step came from. And have your staff give the stair a thorough cleaning."
Caleb sighed.
"Be a waste of time for hard-working folk. It'll only come back." "I fancy not," Phelps remarked. "I put a strong enough holding on that step to restrain it for at least 2 days, which is more than enough. And now I believe it is time for us to enjoy a walk in the woods." "We shall miss our dinner," Whitmo said morosely as we walked out over the lawn.
It was late afternoon, and the sun had just managed to send a few golden streaks in under the blanket of clouds that had gathered overhead. Even so, the air was chill, and I was grateful for the muffler that had been lent to me before we set off. But Phelps paid no heed to us and continued to march through the trees. We had left the house from the front doors, cut across the overgrown mess that passed for a lawn, and then plunged into the outskirts of the forest. Whitmo walked in front, zigzagging this way and that, clearly none too sure of where we were going.
"It's been years, you see," he explained apologetically. "All these trees start to look the same eventually."
Phelps paused under an aspen, gently running a finger over the bark.
"Do you remember what kind of tree it was?"
"An oak," Whitmo replied promptly. "It was an unusually cold winter that year, and we ran out of firewood, so we were obliged to cut some extra.
Our carpenter merely used some of the leftover timber to mend the stairs. And I suppose the rest has been burnt?
Long since.
That is unfortunate, said Phelps with a sigh, and pushed past Whitmo into the woods. The latter gave me a long-suffering look before picking up his pace and hurrying after. But due to my skirts and other factors, I was unable to keep up, and soon had to make my way by following the trail of broken branches the others had left behind. Only Caleb stayed behind with me and helped me over the larger obstacles. When at last we caught up with them, Phelps was busily clearing away bracken and fallen branches from something that looked, beneath it all, to be an old tree stump. Whitmo was standing not far off with a look of mild astonishment on his face.
"I don't understand how he found it," he said to me.
"I got as properly turned around back there, and he just made straight for it as if—"
"As if I could smell it?"
Phelps asked, an amused glint in his eye. He flicked away the last few twigs, and there, sure enough, was an old tree stump. It was wide and cracked with age and time. Half of it was obscured by the remains of an old fungus, long since dead and blackened. But sure enough, there it was. Whitmo opened and shut his mouth without any sound coming out, and eventually gave up. Caleb looked interested, but confused. Together we watched in silence as Phelps gently spread his hands over the stump, his eyes closed, and his face pinched and intent. Then he took out his pocket knife and began to count the growth rings of the stump, quietly and carefully. All the while the forest grew steadily darker and colder. Caleb raised a light, but it was a poor substitute for the comfort of indoors, and by the time Phelps had finished we were all shivering. He stood up from the stump, his face perfectly blank. But there was a sparkle in his eye and a keenness to the arch of his neck that told me plainly he had got what he had come for.
"Well, there is that,"
said he, smartly brushing a few remaining twigs and leaves off his overcoat. "I think, if we hurry, we'll be just in time for supper." And he set off through the trees.
"But Mr. Phelps, sir!"
Whitmo protested, crashing away after him as we struggled to keep up.
"The mystery! There is no mystery, Mr. Whitmo,"
Phelps said over his shoulder.
"Only a grave mistake. In fact, there have been many mistakes on the part of many different people."
And he refused to say another word until we had burst out of the forest and onto the house grounds. Dusk was gathering fast, and I was grateful to be at last in sight of the twinkling gold lights of House Woodwell. I felt somewhat faint from lack of food, although my belly still felt volatile and unfriendly. Phelps strode on ahead of us, his hands plunged deep into his coat pockets, and his chin sunk upon his breast. He was waiting for us on the steps, an absent look on his face.
"Mr. Phelps, for the Lord's sake, I can't stand this any longer!"
Whitmo cried, fairly throwing himself upon the stairs.
"Can you please, I beg of you, tell me the true cause of my wife's death?"
Phelps raised both eyebrows.
"The true cause was sheer bad fortune, Mr. Whitmo. That, and a small oversight on the part of whoever mended those stairs."
"But surely there was more."
"Indeed, much more, but I do not have all the relevant facts at hand yet. I think I shall require the use of your library for some time. Perhaps will you and Corian and the good wizard treat yourselves to a spot of supper."
And that was exactly what he did. Although supper was a silent, cheerless affair, I still managed to ingest sufficient nourishment that, when we were all gathered in that fateful room again, I was able to give Phelps my full attention. It was not hard to do, for in he swept the moment after Whitmo and Caleb had poured themselves glasses of brandy, carrying a thick dusty book under one arm and a hammer on his other.
"Gentlemen, I feel I have tried you long enough," he said, setting the book down on the coffee table with a thump. "But first I intend to remove the cause of all this nuisance."
And with that he sprang up the stair, which was still rather soggy from the cleaning, hammer in hand, to kneel by the top step.
"Excuse me, sir," Caleb asked, "but what in the devil's name are you doing?"
He was answered by the sound of carpet being torn away and then the scrape and creak of wood against wood, and finally a grinding crack as Phelps lifted one slat of the stair free.
"Putting an end to this conflict," he said, and out popped another piece.
He turned them over in his hands, gently feeling the grain of the wood, then tucked them under his arm and, putting one leg over the banister, slid down it like a schoolboy. He placed the wood upon the table, and I noticed with a shock that already there was a small patch of red oozing out of one of the pieces.
"Well, call me a bush wizard and no mistake," cried Caleb, leaping up to inspect it.
Phelps shot me an exasperated look, but it only lasted for a moment.
"Indeed," said he, "but I have not finished yet."
"Yes," said Whitmo, "I still cannot imagine how wood from a tree could come to bleed."
"Well, may you ask," Phelps said, snatching up the dusty old book. "The final piece of the puzzle you can find here in this book, although I only checked it to be absolutely certain that my suspicions were correct, and it seems they were justified."
"Then pray," said Whitmo, almost patronizingly,
"how did the stairway come to bleed?"
"Because that wood," he pointed at the two pieces lying innocently on the table,
"came from a tree that was not really a tree at all."
"You don't mean to say."
Caleb, who had been turning the pieces over in his hands, put them down again, a look of wonder mixed with horror spreading across his face.
Phelps looked sadly down at the pieces of wood and shook his head. "It was once a woman, by the name of Elamina Helk."
There was a stunned silence from the other two men at this.
Phelps laid the book upon the table and flipped it open, going through the pages carefully until he found what he wanted. "There," he said, sliding it over to us, and we all craned our necks to see.
"But this is only the family compendium of myths and legends," cried Whitmo at once, but Caleb touched him warningly on the shoulder.
"It is close enough," Phelps replied, "and it tallies with all the other facts."
"Facts? What other facts have you been able to collect, Mr. Phelps? Because I would be very interesting in hearing—"
"Peace, Mr. Whitmo, you shall. Corian, would you be good enough to read out loud the entry halfway down page 246, labelled Helk?"
I pulled the book toward me with a sigh. It was so old the pages were yellow. It was a wonder the ink had not faded away completely. I ran my finger down page 246 until it landed on the entry for Helk, Elamina, next to a picture of an astonishingly good-looking woman dressed in an ancient style. I cleared my throat and tried to sit up straight like a proper lady.
"Helk, Elamina," I read. "The daughter of Mallard Helk came to Dartfordale with her father in 2134, settled in Shentwood 5 years later. Not long after, she was betrothed to the local baron, Sir Junton, who had a reputation as a scoundrel and drunkard. As was the custom at the time for women who were forced to marry against their will, she sought help from the Maiads, the tree folk in her home forest. The last that was seen of her was on her wedding eve, when she took a walk in the forest and never came back. The place was full of wolves at the time, and many assumed she had been devoured. Yet no trace of a corpse or a struggle was to be seen, no matter how hard her father hunted, and it is held by some that she did not, in fact, die, but was turned into a tree by the grace of the Maiads. Certainly her father believed this, for when he built what is now House Woodwell, he refused to cut timber from the surrounding forest, and insisted on having it shipped in, at great expense, so as not to risk inadvertently killing his own daughter." I finished slowly, as in my head all the pieces came together, and I nearly felt faint again as I slid the book back to Phelps. "It seems she was not able to avoid the axe forever," he remarked, turning the book over in his hands. "Understandable. It's a very difficult thing to do when you're standing still." "That is unbelievable," Whitmo said, leaning back in his chair, stricken.
"There is your proof," Phelps said quietly, pointing at the bleeding boards. "Trees, even those that have been possessed by myads, never bleed anything but sap. But if you want something more definitive, take a look at what I removed from the heart of the stump we visited this evening." He reached out his hand and dropped something small and white onto the table. It was about the size of a doll's teacup, notched and spiked in an irregular manner. It meant nothing to me, but both Whitmo and Caleb gave out gasps of surprise mixed with horror and leaned back from the thing as if it would bite them. I looked questioningly at Phelps. "An anatomically adept person would identify that as a single human spinal vertebra. It was buried in the wood and almost impossible to see, but it proves that, at heart at least, that tree was still human." Whitmo had his head in his hands and was rocking back and forth in his seat, moaning, "What have I done? What have I done?" "Nothing someone else would not have done as well, given enough time," Phelps said, scooping up the bone and putting it surreptitiously away in his pocket. "Tell me one thing, Mr. Phelps. What is it? Was Elamina... those steps, were they responsible for my wife's death?" Phelps was silent for a moment and looked thoughtfully at the innocent pieces of wood. "Well, I can hardly answer that," said he. "I imagine she harbored some resentment toward your family for cutting her up, and had been gathering bad luck around her remaining pieces for some time." "So, indirectly, yes." "What shall I do?" "You shall take those pieces of wood away and lay them to rest with the stump. Hopefully that will be enough to allay Elamina's spirit, although the rest of her has already been burned. Then I believe you should ship in some excellent Ennish timber to replace those steps. But before that, I suggest you organize a dogcart to take Miss Birch and myself back to the train station. Our work here is done, and I think we can just catch the 9:17. "An amusing case, and not without merit," Phelps said some time later when we were on the train heading home. "Perhaps for you," said I, a little ruffled. "I still can't understand how you figured it all out."
"How do you mean?"
"Where the blood came from, what the blood was coming from, how it all happened. Good gracious, Mr. Phelps, sometimes I think your mind works by a completely different set of rules than the rest of us."
Phelps looked sharply over at me, one eyebrow arched and his eyes very bright. I wondered for a second if I'd angered him. But a moment later he smiled, a real, gratified smile that I had never thought his face could hold.
"In thinking that," said he, "you have come closer to the truth than anyone else ever has."
He crossed his legs and looked out the window, staring perhaps at our reflections, for the outside was black as pitch.
"The blood was unexpected, no doubt, but not a mystery," he remarked after some time. "It was obvious to me from the first that it was not of natural origin, and when I detected strong magical remnants about that top stair, well, my suspicions were confirmed, as you saw. It was not hard from there to determine the nature of the magic. The age of the house and the fact that all its timber had been shipped in, when itself sat in the very heart of the forest, was also suggestive. Women in those days were often turned into trees for one reason or another. Of course, it was still wildly unlucky for them to cut that particular tree, but there could be no other explanation. And when I sensed the remains of the Maiad spell that had held her in the form of that tree, well, the situation seemed clear enough. And finally I confirmed my suspicions by looking up the history of the man who built the house, and thus found the name of our little mystery. Elamina Helk."
The train rattled on through the night, and my mind spun as all the pieces fell into place.
"That is quite remarkable," I said. "I should never have guessed."
"Corian," my guardian said, with a hint of reproach in his voice, "it was not a guess. It should never be a guess when it comes to matters of magic, unless you would allow things to go terribly, terribly wrong. I see you have about as much magical expertise as the next layman, and though it is this dearth of practical knowledge that allows me to transform what would otherwise be a mere hobby into a viable profession, I shall suffer no ward of mine to exhibit such qualities. No! I suppose I shall have to have a hand in the governess you choose, just to be sure she isn't as backwards in that area as the rest. The end. The Crimson Stair was one of the first stories I submitted to an editor. When I went back to check on it, after I had finished the first volume of Boragner Phelps' stories, I was immensely glad it had never been bought. Too many amateur mistakes, since corrected. Of course, one could argue that that was why it hadn't been picked up, and I think it reflects better on all concerned that we continue to think that was the reason it was never picked up. In any case, I do not think it would have done well in a collection of unrelated stories. It is too much part of its own series, and works much better when read, or listened to, within that context. Though both Phelps and Corian have since gone on to bigger and better things, The Crimson Stair still provides a little glimpse into what the future holds, and I think it was when I wrote The Crimson Stair that I realized, yes, I'm onto something. I can make the series work. If you are interested in reading The Crimson Stair, or more stories about Phelps, or indeed more stories by me, period, you can find all these available as ebooks on the Amazon Kindle store, the iTunes iBook store, and the Barnes & Noble Nook store. Readers in the UK, France, and Germany can order directly from their national Kindle or iTunes site, as can iTunes users in Canada and Australia. Basically, if your country has a Kindle or an iTunes store, my stuff is probably on it. For a complete catalog of my titles, you can go to goldeneogawa.com/books. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Radio Grimbald, and tune in next week when I read the third Phelps story, The Unholy Cathedral. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please drop me an email at goldeneogawa, that's goldeneogawa, @gmail.com, or follow me on Twitter at grimbytweets, that's GRIMBY tweets. I shouldn't have to tell you how to spell tweets, but it's TWEETS. Special thanks for their help in the production of Radio Grimbald go out to Marion Goldeen, my wonderful mother, Evan Ogawa, and Rachel Goldeen for providing the theme music, and of course to you for listening. Radio Grimbald is performed, produced, edited, and just about everything else by me, Goldeen Ogawa. Find out more on the web at radiogrimbald.com and goldeneogawa.com. Thank you for listening, and until next week, take care and have fun.